innocent virus. According to Koch's postulates, HIV is not guilty of AIDS, but this not guilty verdict is not perceived as innocence by most scientists, particularly by non-scientists, for two reasons. One, the term virus, the Latin word for poison, just by itself inspires fear. Therefore, HIV must be bad. This general prejudice that all viruses are bad is based on the fact that some viruses actually are bad. These pathogenic viruses and microbes are to researchers and to the press what criminals are to detectives, the focus and justification of their existence. But only a few people know that the great majority of all viruses and microbes cause no disease at all. Such viruses are called passenger viruses. They are the most uninteresting of all viruses to virologists because the standing of virologists in the scientific community depends on the pathogenic potential of the viruses they study. Since passenger viruses do not advertise their presence by causing a disease, most of them go unnoticed, riding with their hosts like a passenger in an airplane. Passengers are the silent majority of animal and human viruses. Pathogenic viruses are just the tip of the iceberg. Passenger viruses infect just enough cells of the host to survive without ever causing a disease. Since passenger viruses keep such a low profile, virologists could not easily detect them until recently, when the technology was developed to detect needles in a haystack. Because a passenger virus neither hurts nor kills, it is the most efficient survivor and hence the most common virus in animals and man. 2. The second reason even scientists consider HIV not innocent in AIDS is the much-cited overwhelming correlation between HIV and AIDS. However, the HIV correlation argument is not just misleading, it is deceptive on three counts. First, the overwhelming correlation is not with HIV, but with an antibody against it, a difference like day and night. A virus is a potential pathogen, an antibody is a certain antidote. Second, American and European AIDS risk groups have one common microbial denominator. They have many more microbes and many more antibodies against microbes than the rest of the population. This is because, from a microbiologist's point of view, AIDS risk behavior is collecting microbes in the process of many sexual contacts with different persons, promiscuity, sharing needles during intravenous drug use, consumption of unsterile drugs, prostitution for drugs, or receiving transfusions for hemophilia. No matter what microbe one chooses, toxoplasma, bacteria causing syphilis, genital wart virus, human T-cell leukemia virus, cytomegalovirus, one of the many herpes viruses, hepatitis virus, or HIV, it correlates overwhelmingly with risk behavior. In fact, three of these microbes, namely syphilis, HTLV-1, and cytomegalovirus, were considered AIDS causes before HIV because of overwhelming correlations with antibodies against them. However, since HIV was chosen rather than proved to be the cause of AIDS in 1984, the correlation with HIV and AIDS became 100% the definition of AIDS. Therefore, the overwhelming correlation is one of the purest examples of circular logic. Third, the literature includes more than 4,621 clinically diagnosed AIDS cases that are all HIV-free. To cover up this discrepancy with the overwhelming correlation, HIV-free AIDS cases were renamed in 1992 as idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia, ICL cases by the CDC and Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Thus, the overwhelming correlation between antibodies against HIV and AIDS is a mere consequence of risk behavior and of the definition of AIDS. It is irrelevant for causation. The scientific method offers three unambiguous criteria on how to tell a virus that is potentially guilty by association from one that is an innocent passenger virus. 1. The time between infection and a passenger virus and the occurrence of any disease, if one occurs, is entirely unpredictable. It could be anywhere from a day to the lifetime of the patient. Since the passenger virus does not cause a disease, the time of infection is irrelevant to the onset of a disease. 2. A passenger virus can be active or passive, rare or abundant during any disease. Since the passenger does not cause disease, its activity is irrelevant to it. 3. The passenger virus can be present or absent during any disease. Since the virus is not pathogenic, disease can occur in the absence of the passenger virus. In short, a virus that has been in its host for years before a disease occurs, that is, typically inactive and rare during a disease, and that is not present in every case of that disease, is not a credible suspect for viral disease. It is an innocent bystander or a passenger virus. HIV meets all of these criteria. Since HIV also fails Koch's postulates, there is no rational basis for the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. In the courts of science, HIV must be acquitted of all charges for AIDS. It is an innocent virus. AIDS not infectious. In December 1994, Science wrote a surprising editorial blaming a newly discovered herpes virus for Kaposi sarcoma. The surprise was that the AIDS orthodoxy had adopted the view that another virus could cause AIDS. Although this article should have registered a major heresy among AIDS scientists, it did not. It was received instead only as a minor sin because it did not question the central, although tacit, dogma of the AIDS orthodoxy, infectious AIDS. Questioning infectious AIDS is without doubt the ultimate heresy in the AIDS orthodoxy. The fear of questions about the orthodoxy's most carefully cultivated dogma is understandable because AIDS does not meet the classic epidemiological criteria of an infectious disease. 1. Infectious diseases do not discriminate between sexes. The first epidemiological law of viral and microbial diseases holds that men and women are affected equally because no virus or microbe discriminates between the sexes. This law applies to all known infectious diseases affecting large populations. Examples are flu, polio, syphilis, hepatitis, tuberculosis, pneumonia, and herpes, all of which do not discriminate between the sexes, nor do they select their victims only from specific risk groups. By contrast, AIDS selects all its victims from a few newly established AIDS risk groups: long-term intravenous drug addicts and their babies, male homosexuals using recreational drugs, and hemophiliacs under long-term treatment with commercial clotting factor VIII. Breaking with the sexual equality displayed by conventional infectious diseases, AIDS attacks men 10 times more often than women in Europe and the United States. Among men, it decidedly prefers homosexuals to heterosexuals. Thus, American and European AIDS is not distributed between the sexes like an infectious disease. Chapter 8 explains why African AIDS does not discriminate between men and women. 2. Farr's Law. Infectious diseases spread exponentially. Early in the last century, the British epidemiologist William Farr first recognized the seasonal rise and fall of microbial epidemics. A new infectious disease rapidly explodes in a population, just as rapidly as microbes are transmitted from person to person. Then it declines within months because it is stopped by the elimination of susceptible victims, either by death or more often by natural immunization. In accordance with Farr's law, the Hawaiian natives, the California Indians, and the Eskimos were all quickly decimated by European microbes once they had been introduced to them by the European discoverers. But survivors soon became as resistant to these microbes as the Europeans. Likewise, contemporary Americans and Europeans suffer from new seasonal flu epidemics following Farr's law to the letter. Figure 1 shows the exponential rise and fall of a new seasonal flu epidemic against the backgrounds of several long-established microbes. Since the percentage of Americans with herpes virus, cytomegalovirus, and the fungal parasites pneumocystis and candida is constant over time, these are old American microbes. Surprisingly, HIV is one of them, because 1 in 250 Americans, 0.4%, have been positive ever since HIV could be detected in 1984. Thus, contrary to its reputation, HIV is an old American virus. The distribution over time of a new hypothetical flu epidemic against the background of several parasites long established in the United States. The long-established parasites differ from a new one in their distribution over time. According to Farr's law, the new one rises and falls, or equilibrates exponentially. The old ones remain steady. Its unchanging incidence in the United States identifies HIV as an old American virus. Figure 2A compares the time course of the American AIDS epidemic with that of the American HIV epidemic. The comparison offers another surprise. The HIV epidemic is constant and thus old, but the AIDS epidemic is increasing and thus new. Since the two epidemics follow totally different time courses, the HIV epidemic cannot possibly be the cause of the AIDS epidemic. In sharp contrast to the bell-shaped curve of a conventional new infectious epidemic like the flu epidemic shown in Figure 1, the AIDS epidemic increased steadily for 15 years. American AIDS gradually spread from a few dozen cases annually in 1981 to more than 80,000 cases in 1994. It did not explode as the HIV orthodoxy predicted, neither did it decline as would be expected from antiviral immunity. Instead of resembling an infectious disease, the time course of the AIDS epidemic resembles the slow, progressing epidemics of lung cancer and emphysema in industrialized nations, building up over the years in step with tobacco consumption. These non-infectious epidemics neither rose exponentially nor affected all groups of the population or both sexes equally, nor did they disappear as a result of antiviral immunity or natural resistance. Thus, AIDS does not meet the classical epidemiological criteria of an infectious disease. The failure of AIDS to meet these criteria destroys not only all hopes of the HIV orthodoxy ever to prove that HIV causes AIDS, but also any other viral or bacterial theories of AIDS. Despite all these violations of the fundamental principles of virology and epidemiology, the virus-AIDS hypothesis has remained the sole basis for our unproductive war on AIDS. This is as much a scientific as a human tragedy. The reckless rule of the HIV-AIDS monopoly breaches the most fundamental principle of disease control. First find the cause, then fight the cause, and closes the door for alternative hypotheses that might be productive. Defending the low ground. After the polio epidemic ended, no new diseases and no fundamentally different viruses were being discovered. To maintain a medical relevance, virologists began connecting known viruses to unexplained diseases, such as cancer or multiple sclerosis. Because these diseases in no way behave as traditional infectious diseases, the virus hunters had to invent new properties for the germs. First, the incubation period of viruses, typically anywhere between 1 day and 3 weeks, was allowed to stretch into years. Then antibodies had to be abandoned as a sign of immunity against the microbes. And since the viruses never reappeared during disease, indirect methods of damage had to be postulated. Nevertheless, all these creative maneuvers merely delayed the inevitable. By the early 1980s, virology was withering from lack of public interest, a fatal weakness when trying to attract new recruits, research money, and federal programs. The public was losing faith in wars on cancer that were never won, or wars on diseases that rarely affected the average person. But AIDS has changed everything. Reviving virus hunting is the most glamorous and rewarding branch of biomedical research. To blame HIV for AIDS, virologists had to employ every invention at their disposal, including an ever-expanding latent period, an antibody test, and plenty of paradoxes to keep tens of thousands of investigators busy for many years. The evolution toward these false assumptions had been so gradual, so favored by consensus politics within science, and so shaped by the increasing sensitivity of biotechnology, that most researchers had been lulled into thinking of such rationalizations as normal science. By the time Robert Gallo and other virus hunters had engraved the HIV hypothesis in stone, anyone who dared to raise serious questions appeared truly radical to the rest of the research establishment. Peter Duisberg first began to ask his colleagues questions about the HIV hypothesis shortly after Gallo's 1984 press conference. The HIV dissidents could see two fundamental problems. HIV was a retrovirus, meaning it should not kill the cells it infected, and the virus could barely be detected even in late-stage AIDS patients. The following year, the NIH awarded Duisberg its Outstanding Investigator Grant, a special 7-year award officially designed to allow free inquiry and latitude for exploring risky new research directions. He took this mandate to heart. As the discussions over HIV continued quietly, He began exploring the issue as a potentially important shift from his usual work on cancer genes and animal retroviruses. Upon hearing of Duisberg's doubts about whether retroviruses could cause cancer in humans or most animals, the editor of Cancer Research invited him to write a special review paper in 1985. Duisberg spent many months compiling the evidence from the scientific literature. While he was working on this piece, the questions about HIV began intruding into his thinking ever more prominently. He finally decided to add a section arguing that HIV could not cause AIDS, citing data that showed HIV was inactive in the body, did not kill T cells, and could not possibly have a long latent period before inducing AIDS. He was still writing the paper in 1986 when he took 9 months' leave from Berkeley to work in another retrovirus lab at the NIH facility in Bethesda, Maryland. As chance would have it, he worked in the building that housed Gallo's laboratory, though on a different floor. This afforded him many opportunities to test his growing suspicions of the virus AIDS hypothesis. Not yet realizing Duisberg's intentions, Gallo invited him to be the featured speaker at one of his regular lab seminars. Gallo seemed to enjoy most of Duisberg's talk, which questioned the importance of cancer genes, and did not even become upset when Duisberg threw in a short criticism of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis at the end. Apparently, Gallo thought Duisberg was not really serious, merely dabbling for fun. But the following weeks brought increasingly tense conversations between them, in which Duisberg would constantly raise new questions. One day, such a discussion took place in the elevator on the way to Gallo's lab. Gallo burst into such anger over Duisberg's persistence that he left the elevator on the wrong floor, missing the lab where he had worked for many years. Although Gallo increasingly resisted talking about HIV, several researchers in his lab privately admitted to Duisberg the enormous problem of not finding the virus active in the body. They knew perfectly well something had to give. Rather than abandon HIV, however, they told Duisberg they hoped to explain the problem using cofactors or other rationalizations. Naturally, these experiences began confirming Duisberg's suspicion that he had stumbled onto something profound. Duisberg's 22-page review paper appeared in the March 1987 issue of Cancer Research. Colleagues found the section on AIDS especially shocking, privately admitting the importance of the questions about HIV. To this very day, not one scientist has come forward to answer the paper. Traditionally, such deafening silence has been interpreted as a victory for the author, indicating the arguments to be irrefutable. However, despite being unable to find any flaws in the article, no researcher could afford to take on the powerful HIV/AIDS establishment. Unwilling to risk status and career by challenging the growing AIDS research structure but having no arguments to defend the virus hypothesis, scientists chose the safety of continuing their studies of HIV, claiming that it was at least an interesting virus. Some researchers became quite sensitive about the virus hypothesis, reacting angrily to any criticisms. The cancer research paper nevertheless generated some interest, and upon invitation, Duisberg wrote a guest editorial in Biotechnology that November. Again, no answer. The wide circulation Science soon ran an article on the emerging controversy, placing Duisberg in a rather unsympathetic light. Prompted by Duisberg's letter in response, the editor decided to set up an official debate in this journal, which appeared in July of 1988. Duisberg was on one side, opposing Gallo, Howard Temin, and the epidemiologist William Blattner. Each side offered an opening page and a rebuttal to the opposition's opening page, that was all. Science has therefore refused to publish anything but an occasional letter on the topic, declaring it received as much coverage as it deserved. Although before this exchange Duisberg still had doubts, he became thoroughly convinced the virus was harmless after seeing this faltering inability to answer his arguments. As he further immersed himself in the AIDS literature, the sheer volume of damning evidence became overwhelming. In a response to the short science debate, he wrote an extended update paper, which after months of fighting he managed to publish in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 1989. This paper was printed on the express condition that another virologist would respond with an equal rebuttal. Gallo himself promised such, but had not delivered as of this date. Once again, no scientist has ever chosen to answer that piece, nor to answer Duisberg's subsequent review papers in Research in Immunology or the Proceedings. Only a few, in short, general responses to Duisberg have appeared in other journals. The brief debate forum in Science, short exchanges in some 1989 issues of the Journal of AIDS Research, terse letters in a May 1990 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, a blatantly ad hominem attack in the pages of Nature during June of 1990, and a few editorials in 1993. But in December 1994, Science published an 8-page article on the Duisburg phenomenon by the journal's foremost AIDS journalist. The article acknowledges that the Duisburg phenomenon has not gone away and may be growing. Although tendentious for the HIV hypothesis, the article made some telling concessions. 1. According to some AIDS researchers, not all, HIV now, but not earlier when it was named the AIDS virus, fulfills the classic postulates of Koch. And 2. AZT and illicit drugs, which Duisburg argues can cause AIDS, don't cause the immune deficiency characteristic of that disease, knowing full well that about 30 different diseases are said to be characteristic of the disease. From these and experts of Gallo's own writings, the standard defense of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis can be reconstructed. None of the most influential AIDS scientists has ever published a definitive defense of HIV, yet when confronted with the paradoxes, they all answer with similar arguments. Otherwise, they prefer to ignore the questions. The arguments for HIV fall into four categories. 1. Arguing for HIV by ignoring the facts. The case for HIV as an AIDS virus depends first on bypassing Koch's postulates. The most complete rationale for this is presented by Gallo in his 1991 book, Virus Hunting, AIDS, Cancer, and the Human Retrovirus, A Story of Scientific Discovery, where he coolly disposes of these time-tested standards. Rules were needed then and can be helpful now, but not if they are too blindly followed. Robert Koch, a great microbiologist, has suffered from a malady that affects many other great men. He has been taken too literally and too seriously for too long. We forget at times that we have made great progress in the last century in developing tools, reagents, and diagnostic techniques far beyond Koch's wildest fantasies. Koch's postulates, while continuing to be an excellent teaching device, are far from absolute in the real world outside the classroom, and probably should not be in the classroom anymore except in a historical and balanced manner. They were not always fulfilled even in his time. Certainly, they did not anticipate the new approaches available to us, especially in molecular biology, immunology, and epidemiology, or the special problems created by viruses. They were, after all, conceived only for bacterial disease, and even here they often fail. Sometimes they are impossible to fulfill. Many times one might even want to try to do so. And sometimes they are quite simply erroneous standards. But Koch's postulates consist of elementary logic, whereas technology is continually being outdated, logic is permanent. Koch's rules, after all, simply restate the germ theory itself in experimental terms. Gallo never tries to explain how logic would change over time. Indeed, in this age of ultra-sensitive biotechnology, such rules take on more importance than ever in sorting out relevant data from mere trivia. Nor does Gallo offer any rigorous scientific rules to replace Koch's postulates, leaving HIV science with no standards at all. Gallo continues by misstating Koch's postulates, falsely claiming that a germ is required to cause a disease every single time it infects a new host. With most microbes, the majority of infected people or animals experience no symptoms. Koch's test only requires that some animals become sick when injected with a disease-causing germ, or that vaccination prevents the illness. Gallo then cites false or misleading examples of germs that supposedly fail the postulates despite causing disease, pretending, for example, that the hepatitis and flu viruses cause no disease in animals. Gallo misses the point that the failure of a given germ to meet Koch's postulate does not call the postulate into question, but rather the germ as the cause of a disease. Or he draws examples from the slow virus hypotheses, including measles, SSPE, papilloma, cervical cancer, HDLV-1 leukemia, and feline leukemia virus. Or he cites diseases erroneously thought to result from bacteria, such as neurosyphilis. In reality, all truly viral diseases do fulfill Koch's standards perfectly. Yellow fever, measles, polio, chickenpox, herpes, hepatitis A and B, and flu, among others. Gallows, these postulates are too old argument, is repeated by English retrovirus hunter Robin Weiss and American CDC official Harold Jaffe. What seems bizarre is that anyone should demand strict adherence to these unreconstructed postulates 100 years after their proposition. Weiss and Jaffe also forget to explain how logical rules could become outdated and again proceed to misquote Koch and use misleading examples of disease-causing microbes supposedly failing the postulates. It is generally assumed that stardom in a given field is directly proportional to knowledge. The more famous a person is, the more he knows about his field. However, a star is often born by a coincidence in which the most desirable solution to problems is delivered to the best prepared audience. To deliver such a popular solution requires a complete knowledge of the politics of science, but not of science itself. As we shall hear, Gallo and Montagnier fit the formula for scientific stardom in this regard exactly. Both had studied retroviruses as causes of cancer for more than a decade when AIDS appeared. But neither one had studied other non-infectious causes of diseases, not even other viruses, nor had they treated AIDS patients after AIDS appeared. Retroviruses were their primary investment and their exclusive expertise. Having persuaded himself to ignore the traditional rules of Robert Koch, Gallo joins with Luc Montagnier in substituting a previously unknown postulate. That HIV is the cause of AIDS is by now firmly established. The evidence for causation includes the fact that HIV is a new pathogen, fulfilling the original postulate of new disease, new agent. Superficially, it appears logical to postulate that a new virus would cause a new disease. However, Gallo and Montagnier's argument fails because it ignores a multiplicity of facts. 1. AIDS is not a disease. Instead, the AIDS syndrome is a steadily growing collection of currently about 30 previously known old diseases. Surprisingly, in a view of their notoriety for AIDS, neither Gallo nor Montagnier know the AIDS definition. It is true, however, that the incidence of AIDS diseases has increased dramatically in the 1980s, as intravenous drug use has increased and as both the consumption of recreational drugs used as sexual stimulants and the use of AZT as antiviral drug have increased in male homosexuals. 2. HIV is not a new agent. According to Farr's law, a virus is new if the percentage of infected people increases rapidly over time or explodes, as the CDC predicted in the early days of AIDS. A virus is old if the percentage of infected people is stable over time. Since the number of HIV-infected Americans has been an unchanging 1 million since HIV was able to be tested in 1985, HIV is an old virus in the United States. In order to misjudge the age of HIV so grossly, Gallo and Montagnier must have been unaware of the epidemiology of HIV in the United States and unaware of Farr's law. Gallo and Montagnier probably assumed HIV is new because it was newly discovered by them. But since the technology used to detect HIV is just as new as the discovery of HIV, there is another interpretation. Gallo and Montagnier discovered a previously unknown but old virus with a new technique. Their claim that HIV is new is just as naive as the claim of an astronomer that a previously unknown star is new because it became detectable with a new telescope. Since HIV is old in the United States and the epidemic of AIDS diseases is new, HIV is not a plausible cause for a new rise of AIDS diseases in the United States. 3. AIDS is not an infectious viral epidemic as Gallo and Montagnier assume. AIDS fails all epidemiological criteria of an infectious disease. Gallo and Montagnier completely ignore the evidence that the new AIDS epidemic could well be the consequence of the new recreational drug use epidemic that started in America after the Vietnam War. Apparently, neither Gallo nor Montagnier were aware of the lifestyle hypothesis, which originally proposed that AIDS patients were suffering from drug diseases because all early AIDS patients were recreational drug users. To distinguish between toxic drugs and toxic microbes, Gallo and Montagnier should have investigated whether AIDS is infectious or not. But Gallo and Montagnier completely ignored that AIDS does not meet even one of the classical epidemiological criteria of infectious diseases, possibly because they never considered non-viral causes of disease. 4. Considering that hundreds of known retroviruses are harmless passenger viruses, one would have expected that the leading retrovirologists Gallo and Montagnier would have explained why they believe that HIV is fatally pathogenic. Yet all that Gallo and Montagnier had to offer in support of HIV pathology was their own credibility. Indeed, Gallo's and Montagnier's reasoning fits their narrow expertise exactly. Two leading retrovirologists agreeing on a retrovirus as the cause of AIDS and ignoring all competing retroviral and non-retroviral explanations. And for the leaders, ignorance is bliss. 2. Arguing for HIV based on inappropriate models. When confronted with the paradoxes of HIV, its defenders simply reach for their bag of virus hypotheses, pulling out on demand a mixture of invented or misinterpreted models. They usually cite viral precedents of three types. The first comes from the supposed slow viruses, which are used to justify the long latency period of HIV, but which fall apart in the light of the evidence presented above. The second model suggests HIV reactivation based on authentic prototypes. Herpes simplex virus, for example, can cause lesions even long after the first antibodies against the virus have been produced. However, this can happen only if the virus is reactivated because the original antibodies and antiviral T cells have dropped below a safe threshold level. After reactivation, the virus multiplies into large numbers, just as in the original infection. Using this model, HIV scientists justify both the latent period and antibody test in one breath. But herpes produces the same lesions upon first infecting the body as it does upon reactivation, and antibodies neutralize it both early and late. Herpes can only recur because it hides in certain nerve cells, waiting until some future opportunity when the host's immune function is temporarily reduced. Once the immune system regains strength, the virus is again suppressed and the sores disappear. HIV, on the other hand, is alleged to kill its host only years after being neutralized and even without reactivating. There is no HIV reactivation and no HIV in most AIDS patients. The third virus model has been created only since the appearance of AIDS. Some animal retroviruses will cause AIDS when injected into hosts of appropriate species. Simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, a monkey retrovirus, attracts most of the attention. But these animal diseases can be called AIDS only by stretching the definition to extremes. They do not include most of the human AIDS conditions, such as Kaposi sarcoma or dementia. Rather, the animal symptoms usually resemble the flu. The animals become sick within days, or not at all, without long latent periods. Some animals recover by raising an immune response and never suffer a relapse. And those that die must be injected with large quantities of the virus while very young, before they have developed any immune system at all. In the wild, their cousins retain antibodies against SIV all their lives without ever becoming sick from the virus. These laboratory diseases are, in all respects, very traditional viral flu-like diseases. But HIV scientists rename them AIDS. 3. Arguing for HIV based on evasion. Lacking answers to Koch's postulates and authentic virus precedents, AIDS scientists resort to a variety of excuses. The standard evasions fall into four general categories: the arguments from unknowns, from speculation, from authority, and from irresponsibility. The argument from unknowns makes the obvious point that scientists never know everything and implies that the HIV/AIDS question is therefore somehow unimportant now, since it eventually will be resolved through more research. According to this argument, the issue is not whether but how HIV causes AIDS. Paradoxes, therefore, merely prove that further research is needed and that scientific knowledge will consequently expand, not that the virus is itself in question. William Blattner and Robert Gallo of the National Cancer Institute joined with fellow retrovirologist Howard Temin in using typical arguments from unknowns. Biology is an experimental science, and new biological phenomena are continually being discovered. Thus, one cannot conclude that HIV does or does not cause AIDS from Duisberg's cardinal rules of virology. Duisberg's descriptions of the properties of viruses are in error and provide no distinction between knowing the cause of a disease, that is, its etiology, whether, and understanding the pathogenesis of the disease, how. There are many unanswered questions about the pathogenesis of AIDS, but they are not relevant to the conclusion that HIV causes AIDS. The CDC definition of AIDS has been revised several times as new knowledge has become available and will undoubtedly be revised again. Likewise, Robin Weiss and Harold Jaffe assert, it is unwise to conclude that because we do not understand the pathogenesis of HIV in molecular detail, it is therefore harmless. So Duisberg is right to draw attention to our ignorance of how HIV causes disease, but he is wrong to claim that it does not. One need not harp upon molecular quibbles, important though these are for directing research to the prevention or amelioration of HIV infection. To deny the role of HIV in AIDS is deceptive. It should be clear by now that the questions surrounding the alleged pathogenesis of HIV are too many and too substantial to be dismissed as mere quibbles. To assert the role of HIV in AIDS is unscientific, particularly since the guardians of the HIV hypothesis have never suggested which standards could prove the virus harmless. Until they propose a scientific experiment that could disprove the HIV hypothesis, they convey the implicit message that they will accept no evidence against it whatsoever. The argument from speculation is used more often than any other. It uses specialized terms that make it difficult for outsiders to understand, responding to any paradox with one untested assumption after another. For instance, if little or no HIV can be found in the body, scientists propose hidden reservoirs and special routes of infection. If only antibodies against HIV can be found, researchers call them non-neutralizing or ineffective antibodies and assert that the virus mutates too fast for the antibodies to keep up. If the virus does not make animals sick or kill cells in culture, then researchers claim that the virus somehow makes fine distinctions between humans and chimpanzees, something no other virus can do. All these hypotheses are constantly being disproved or shown to be irrelevant, but the reservoir of new evasions is inexhaustible. The argument from authorities cites the overwhelming evidence for HIV without becoming too specific. In another form, it rebuffs inquisitive epidemiologists for lacking clinical evidence while bypassing medical critics for having no epidemiological training. In other words, unless one is an expert in everything, one may not question anything. This response alludes to esoteric scientific data as a reason for critics to remain silent. Blattner, Gallo, and Temin provide perfect examples. In summary, although many questions remain about HIV and AIDS, a huge and continuously growing body of scientific evidence shows that HIV causes AIDS, and thus we conclude that there is overwhelming evidence that HIV causes AIDS. The argument from irresponsibility serves as the answer of last resort. In the vein of a better safe than sorry warning, such HIV defenders as Weiss and Jaffe assert the weapon of fear. If he, Duisberg, and his supporters belittle safe sex, would have us abandon HIV screening of blood donations and curtail research into anti-HIV drugs and vaccines, then their message is perilous. The irony, as will be reviewed later, lies in the danger of the officially approved measures to combat HIV, which are themselves costing lives. 4. Arguing for HIV based on antibody correlations. The three basic arguments outlined previously clearly answer no questions. The only positive evidence in favor of the virus AIDS hypothesis is found in epidemiology, the study of disease epidemics. This field operates entirely by correlation. According to AIDS officials, where HIV goes, AIDS follows. Despite all the sophisticated biotechnology and vast investment in virology, the best evidence for HIV is only by correlation with antibodies present against it. Ironically, the point is made by retrovirologists Blattner, Gallo, and Temin. The strongest evidence that HIV causes AIDS comes from prospective epidemiological studies that document the absolute requirement for HIV infection for the development of AIDS. Or as stated by Weiss and Jaffe, the evidence that HIV causes AIDS is epidemiological and virological, not molecular. Gallo again emphasizes the point in his book, declaring correlation to be one hell of a good beginning. What sort of correlation seems so convincing to AIDS officials? The one usually cited first must be called the geographic overlap. According to Blattner, Gallo, and Temin, epidemiological data shows that AIDS and HIV infection are clustered in the same population groups and in specific geographic locations and in time. Numerous studies have shown that in countries with no persons with HIV antibodies, there is no AIDS, and in countries with many persons with HIV antibodies, there is much AIDS. Additionally, the time of occurrence of AIDS in each country is correlated with the time of introduction of HIV into that country. First HIV is introduced, then AIDS appears. The three HIV advocates fail to mention, however, that a disease is only recorded as AIDS if antibodies to HIV are also found. Second, a titer association is recorded for individual people. Every victim of AIDS has antibodies against HIV, whereas most healthy people do not. This apparently perfect correlation exists in selected surveys that follow people at risk for AIDS, but no national AIDS statistics exist that even document how well HIV compares with AIDS. Clearly, most of the 17 million healthy HIV-positive humans have yet to develop AIDS. Altogether, fewer than 6%, about 1 million, have developed AIDS in the past 10 years. Furthermore, thousands of clinically diagnosed AIDS patients are HIV-free. A third argument evokes powerful emotional sentiments without much substance and works surprisingly well not only on the lay public, but on scientists as well. When challenged that only people with serious health risks develop AIDS, experts answer with anecdotes, even though the same medical officials will consider anecdotes a worthless type of evidence in any other debate. An anecdotal story is one individual case chosen to prove the absence of other health risks, implying HIV was the only factor that could have led to disease. So, for example, epidemiologists will describe a baby contracting HIV and subsequently developing AIDS. But a nation of 250 million people, a few anecdotal cases can always be found to support any medical view. Fourth, AIDS epidemiologists point to their prospective studies, in which the supposedly conclusive proof of the HIV hypothesis can be found. These studies monitor two groups of people over time, one of HIV-positive patients and the other of HIV-negative people in the same age group. According to such reports, the infected people develop AIDS while their uninfected counterparts do not. But all the reports that have also investigated drug use and other non-contagious AIDS risks have found that AIDS correlates with those factors just as well, if not better, than HIV. Yet these HIV-AIDS correlations have proven to be the most powerful arguments to scientists and laymen alike. Only a more complete picture can expose the misleading nature of this sloppy epidemiology. The other statistics. In one strange sense, officials do refer to some genuine correlations between HIV and AIDS. The syndrome, for example, is rarely found in any nation or individual apart from HIV infection. Indeed, the virus and the syndrome correlate with near textbook perfection, ironically illustrating the most fundamental problem with the entire virus-AIDS hypothesis. The connection was artificially constructed. AIDS is a syndrome of about 30 diseases, not a disease. It displays no unique combination of diseases in the patient. Clinically, it is identified by the diagnosis of specific diseases known to medical science for decades or centuries. The CDC has several times increased but never decreased the official list of AIDS indicator diseases, most recently on January 11, 1993. The list now includes brain dementia, chronic diarrhea, cancers such as Kaposi's sarcoma and several lymphomas, and such opportunistic infections as pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, cytomegalovirus infection, herpes, candidiasis, yeast infections, and tuberculosis. Even low T-cell counts in the blood can now be called AIDS with or without real clinical symptoms. Cervical cancer has recently been added to the list, the first AIDS disease that can affect only one gender, in this case women. The purpose behind adding this disease was entirely political, admittedly to increase the number of female AIDS patients, creating an illusion that the syndrome is spreading into the heterosexual population. Originally, the AIDS diseases were tied together because they were all increasing within certain risk groups, but today they are assumed to derive from the common basis of immune deficiency. The overlap between AIDS and certain risk groups still holds true, but as pointed out in Table 1, a significant number of these diseases are not products of weakened immune systems. According to Blattner, Gallo, and Temin, the CDC definition of AIDS has been revised several times as new knowledge has become available and will undoubtedly be revised again. However, neither the CDC nor other advocates of the HIV hypothesis ever identify the new knowledge about HIV that mandates these revisions. It is also remarkable that such new knowledge always derives the list of AIDS-defining illnesses upward. Not once has an AIDS-defining disease been subtracted in the light of new knowledge about HIV. Irrespective of the undisclosed gains in knowledge about HIV, one thing is clear. The repeated upward adjustments in the definition of AIDS have substantially increased the American AIDS statistics, while HIV infections have remained completely flat since 1985. The increasing numbers of new AIDS cases until 1993 have largely been products of the artificial AIDS definitions. Each alteration in that definition has added, not subtracted, diseases to the diagnostic list. Every time the CDC needs higher rates of new AIDS cases, it expands that definition once again, and more diseases are reclassified into the syndrome. With the stroke of a pen, an illusion of the spread of AIDS is created. Prominent officials explain the revisions as products of our growing scientific knowledge, and the lay public feels reassured that federal efforts are justified or perhaps even a little too slow. One might ask how a doctor would distinguish between an AIDS-related tuberculosis and a traditional one. Clinically, the symptoms are identical, so the CDC has stipulated in its current definition that the tuberculosis must be renamed AIDS if antibodies against HIV are also found in the patient. In the absence of previous HIV infection, the disease is classified under its old name, in this case, tuberculosis, and treated accordingly. AIDS, therefore, can never be found apart from HIV infection, entirely by definition. AIDS officials neglect to mention this crucial fact partly from ignorance, most never having read the definition carefully, and in some cases precisely because it shines a disturbing light onto their supposedly perfect epidemiological coincidence between the virus and AIDS. The observation that AIDS always follows HIV in each nation becomes trivial, since testing for antibodies is followed by a renaming of indigenous diseases. The real epidemiological questions, then, must be shifted away from any correlation between antibodies against HIV and AIDS to a correlation between HIV and the separate AIDS diagnostic diseases. Does infection with the virus, independently of any other health risks, lead to an increased risk of contracting pneumonia, cancer, or other diseases? Is HIV new and found in all recent outbreaks of these diseases? Is HIV infection nearly always fatal? The latter question can be answered most easily. Since the HIV test was made available in 1985, the CDC has officially estimated about 1 million Americans to be HIV positive, a figure that has not changed with the accumulation of testing data or the passage of 10 years. Of these, only about 400,000 have been diagnosed with AIDS by the end of 1994. But this statistic does not subtract the normal incidence of the 30 AIDS-defining diseases in 1 million people over 10 years. 2/3 of HIV-positive Americans have not developed any of the AIDS diseases since 1985, even including the most recent expansion in the AIDS definition. Nor will most of them do so. The numbers of new AIDS cases have clearly been leveling off for some time now, although different analysts will place the peak at different times. Michael Fumento, the Colorado-based lawyer who gained some media notoriety with his 1980 book, The Myth of Heterosexual AIDS, draws a curve with its peak in 1987. Two epidemiologists in a 1990 paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association suggest 1988 as the year of leveling. The CDC observed a leveling off in 1994. In any case, a slowly increasing 40,000 to 50,000 new cases of AIDS, 4% to 5% of the infected subpopulation, have appeared before the 1993 revision of the AIDS definition. Hardly the explosion that AIDS as a new infectious disease was once predicted to show. The enormous gap between HIV-infected people and AIDS patients has induced the CDC to play more tricks with the numbers, At the time of this writing, the CDC is considering lowering its official estimate of 1 million HIV-positive Americans to a new total of 600,000 to 800,000. Part of the AIDS scare results from the way the numbers are reported. Rather than giving the numbers of new AIDS cases each year, CDC and other officials use the cumulative total for the current year added to the figures for all years previous, including those victims already dead. So where the annual numbers would remain constant in the first case, the number actually reported to the public grows with each passing year. Such calculation gives the overwhelming but false impression that AIDS is spreading, since the cumulative numbers can only go up. Given enough time, such accounting methods will boost the total AIDS count higher than the number of HIV-positive people. If this method were applied to count the American population, the cumulative number of newborns over several decades would eventually exceed the total number of Americans alive. The common cited 50% to 100% death rate from HIV has been derived not from national statistics, but from studies on carefully selected cohorts of people. Several ongoing epidemiological studies have for years been observing hundreds or at most thousands of homosexual men at risk for AIDS. Large proportions of the men in these studies have already been infected with HIV. But virtually all the subjects also admit to years of heavy drug abuse, extremely promiscuous sexual activity, and long histories of venereal diseases. Indeed, one major study was specifically organized around homosexual men with repeated bouts of hepatitis B. Researchers calculate the high fatality rate of HIV infection from these health risk groups, causally extrapolating these numbers to average heterosexual HIV positives, thus the discrepancy with the higher survival rate among the nation's 1 million HIV positives. The national AIDS figures fall well short of a virus with a nearly 100% fatality rate. But rather than abandon the hypothesis, the experts have chosen to revise the parameters of HIV infection. The latency period was originally calculated in 1984 on the basis of tracing sexual contacts, finding homosexual men developing AIDS an average of 10 months after their last sexual contacts with other AIDS patients. This incubation period has since been stretched to 10 to 12 years between HIV infection and disease. For each year that passes without the predicted explosion in AIDS cases, approximately one more year is added to this incubation time. Even this is insufficient, with only 5% of infected Americans developing AIDS each year. The average latent period would have to be revised up to some 20 years for 100% to become sick. A deeper look at the disease risk of infected populations reveals stranger paradoxes yet. The probability of developing AIDS varies radically between different HIV-positive populations. Sub-Saharan Africa, with infection rates approaching 30% of the population in some areas, has reported only approximately 200,000 AIDS cases to the World Health Organization in the past decade. This stands against 6 million to 8 million Americans infected with HIV since the mid-1980s, whereas more Americans, now over 400,000, have contracted AIDS in a country with only 1 million HIV positives. AIDS patients in Zaire, with about 3 million HIV-infected people, number only in the hundreds. Uganda, internationally considered a model for accurate testing and reporting, had by 1990 only generated some 8,000 AIDS cases out of 1 million HIV positives. Roughly 360,000 infected Haitians have produced only a few hundred AIDS patients. In the industrial nations, homosexuals, heroin addicts, and hemophiliacs face greater probabilities of developing AIDS than do HIV-positive individuals without extraordinary health risks. And infants have a much shorter average latent period, 2 years, as opposed to the 10 years in adults. No virus, including HIV, could possibly discriminate so enormously based on such subtle distinctions between its hosts. HIV would need to perform other miracles to cause AIDS. Virtually all diagnoses of Kaposi sarcoma are made in homosexuals, not in other AIDS risk groups. Intravenous drug addicts disproportionately suffer from tuberculosis, Haitians from toxoplasmosis, and hemophiliacs from pneumonias. African AIDS diseases are basically different, manifesting as tuberculosis, fever, diarrhea, and a slim disease, unlike our wasting syndrome. A homosexual with HIV who may develop Kaposi sarcoma can donate blood for a hemophiliac, But no hemophiliac has ever developed Kaposi's sarcoma from a blood transfusion. Instead, he is more likely to develop pneumonia if he contracts anything at all. Only HIV is common to both victims. No virus could possibly make such distinctions between its hosts. A more likely hypothesis would blame the health risks specific to each group for their different diseases. If the same diseases can be found on the rise in the same risk groups, but also in people without HIV, then the virus would appear to be a harmless passenger. The evidence bears this out. Hemophiliacs without HIV develop progressive immune degeneration, just like the infected ones. HIV-negative babies of infected mothers develop the same dementia-related symptoms as their HIV-positive siblings. Heroin addicts contract the same pneumonias, herpes infections, weight loss, and tuberculosis with or without the virus, and uninfected homosexuals with Kaposi's sarcoma are now being reported. Outbreaks of pneumonias or tuberculosis in recent years have included as many people without the virus as those with it. Thousands of Central Africans with SLIM disease have now been tested for HIV, and over half are completely negative. Given the relatively high cost of HIV antibody tests, most African cases must be diagnosed by symptoms and remain untested for the virus. In the industrial world, upward of one quarter of all AIDS patients remain untested for the antibodies against HIV, with their doctors merely assuming the virus is present. The existing scientific literature records more than 4,600 cases of AIDS-defining conditions in people never infected by HIV. With various AIDS-type diseases increasing in the risk groups even apart from HIV, the virus appears ever less relevant. All circumstantial evidence aside, the ultimate epidemiological test for HIV would be a case-controlled comparison. In such a study, a large number of infected people would be monitored over time and compared with a large number of uninfected people. They would be matched for age, sex, income, and all other health risks, such as drug use. Hemophilia and other medical complications would be excluded. If HIV were truly harmful, the infected group would develop AIDS and the uninfected would not. Scientists would conduct this type of study even before testing Koch's postulates. But no such study testing HIV as an AIDS virus can be found in the more than 100,000 studies to date on this virus. When confronted with the whole of the evidence against them, defenders of the HIV hypothesis will sometimes cite studies comparing notorious AIDS risk groups with and without the virus to show that only those infected will degenerate and die. But none of the vast number of such prospective studies has actually matched two groups for the health risks that might cause AIDS. They have been designed merely to compare the symptoms of AIDS patients with normal people in the same age group, not to determine the cause of the syndrome. Such studies, their marginal and questionable value notwithstanding, are too often quoted by some researchers as proof of the virus AIDS hypothesis. No AIDS virus at all. Given that HIV fails all standards of scientific evidence as an AIDS virus, could another, possibly unidentified virus cause AIDS instead? Such a microbe would have to possess amazing and unprecedented qualities, for AIDS does not behave as a contagious disease at all. The sexual revolution of the past 20 years has caused increases in all the major venereal diseases, including syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and genital warts. The same has occurred with hepatitis B. All of these infectious diseases have spread far beyond their original reservoirs into the general population and affect men and women nearly equally. AIDS, however, has remained absolutely fixed in its original risk groups. Today, a full decade after it first appeared, the syndrome is diagnosed in homosexuals, intravenous drug users, and hemophiliacs some 90% of the time, just as 10 years ago. 9 out of every 10 AIDS patients are male, also just as before. Even the very existence of a latent period strongly suggests that years of health abuse are required for such fatal conditions. Among most AIDS patients in the United States and Europe, one extremely common health risk has been identified: the long-term use of hard drugs. The evidence for this new AIDS hypothesis will be presented in Chapters 8 and AIDS is not contagious, nor is it even a single epidemic. Tragic deaths, time and money wasted, hysterical public debate over a harmless virus These have been the fruits born of a scientific establishment grown too large for genuine science. The creative pursuit of knowledge has been swallowed to satisfy careerism and its voracious appetite for job security, grant money, financial benefits, and prestige. But the monster is twice guilty, for it also destroys or marginalizes those few scientists daring to ask questions. These dissidents against the HIV hypothesis are the subject of the next chapter.